Tuesday morning, May 31st. I want to get this tape done and in the mail. But this is the second of the two tapes, and on it there are three items. The panel discussion on Saturday afternoon entitled The Four Horsemen. And these were four men speaking on the subjects of 1, fear, 2, frustration, 3, doubt, and the fourth horseman, loneliness. On Saturday night, besides the main banquet speaker, Yev G., some of the southern wheels, delegates and past delegates to New York decided they should also have an Al-Anon speaker at that banquet. I don't know why. And besides Jeff G., we had a Dorothy S. from Milwaukee. On Sunday morning, we went back to Racine to the A Center. And as guests of the 12-step group, had a breakfast and enjoyed Lynn Carroll of Hazelden Foundation for a 12 o'clock AA meeting speaker. Seeing this is a 1,200-foot tape, I'll get off of here and start recording the panel.
Please remain seated. We'll open the meeting with a moment of silence. My name is Doug, and I'm an alcoholic. And all of you in the back here, I would like to preface what I say by reminding everyone that anything I say at an AA meeting of any kind is my own opinion. I hope you agree, of course. But if you don't, I haven't drank today, so it works for me. I want to take this opportunity to thank the Southern Conference for asking us, a panel from the North, to participate. I wish we could have come in numbers like you did a month ago to our conference, but we didn't. So we'll have to make it up here. I would like to read from the Alcoholics Anonymous big book, different parts of it, something that's taken from a preamble that we use at our meetings. It says, you may like this program or you may not, but the fact remains that it works and is our only chance of recovery. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. Some people may be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there is a deadly earnestness and a full realization that we must put first things first. With each of us, the first thing is our alcoholic problem. To drink is to die. Faith has to work 24 hours a day, in and through us, or we perish. Today the panel and I are going to go back to the days when there was no worldliness and no levity, to what we remember of the fear, the frustration, the doubt, and the loneliness, which I think are truly the four horsemen of the alcoholics' apocalypse. This is a revelation to us. This is the thing we have to learn about ourselves. This is what we have to rid ourselves of to sustain our sobriety. the chapter of vision for you, it mentions four horsemen. These are substantially the same as we're going to talk about today. We have, I think, very good representation from the complete North. And I would like to first call on our present delegate to New York, Bert C. from Medford, to talk to you on fear. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. I was going to follow the leader and start my talk with, my name is Bert C. And out in the hallways this morning, this has got to come closer, maybe, huh?
No.
No? Somebody said speak up.
Good.
I can't. Out in the hallways this morning, I met several people that I know, and they said, there's Anonymous Chapman. So right away, I thought, well, I'm going to change it. I'm going to say, my name is Bert Chapman. Now, and I am a recovering alcoholic. Without any reservations. And that's something that I hope and pray I'll never forget. If you don't like me, or you don't like what I say, please don't bear any resentments towards Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm an individual member, and what I say is my own opinions, and not those of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I might also add, not those of my home group, which is Medford. I have to explain this Bert Chapman deal. And maybe when I explain it, you'll recognize my sponsor. But when I was first contacted by AA, by my sponsor, I was trying to make a deal, although I didn't tell him, so nobody would know that I was an alcoholic. And the deal I was trying to make is went along something like this. He was going to call me at a certain time the next day to see how I was doing. And at that time, I lived out in the sticks, way out in the woods, on a Forest Service party line. And the only fellas on the line were the lookouts and the guards, the fire guards. And I was trying to figure out how the weather's going to be. And will the lookouts be down? Will the fire guard be off? Because this line was a one short, two long line, or two short. One long, you know, for calls. And my sponsor knew what I was getting at, and I wasn't half as smart as I thought I was. And he got a little bit mad, I guess, because he bellered at me. He said, I know what's bothering you. And he said, I'm going out on a limb. He said, I know very well that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't make any promises. But he said, I'll make a promise to you for Alcoholics Anonymous. And probably I'm breaking a tradition, but he said, I'm still going out on the limb. And he said, my promise to you for Alcoholics Anonymous is that they will keep your anonymity just as private as you kept your last drunk. And you know something? That promise has been kept. I'm going to do things a little different. I'm going to try and give an intelligent talk or an intellectual talk. And of course, I went to the dictionary to look up the definition of fear. And I found fear was defined as a dread or anxiety. And then I came to the word solicitude. So then I had to go back and look up solicitude. And solicitude says, defined as concern, anxious, or apprehensive. And then I kind of laughed to myself, and it made me think of one of the members we had in our group who was a professional man. And he was really bothered and concerned about this word alcoholic. And so he went to the dictionary. And he looked up the word alcoholic. And he found alcoholic is dipsomania. Then he looked up dipsomania. And he found dipsomaniac. And then he said, I'll settle for an alcoholic. And he quit right there. And that's pretty much true, because when I came to solicitude and I thought, well, Dan, then I'd never checked on this, and I checked on it. And it's pretty much true. And so when I came to the word solicitude, I thought, well, hell, I can't give an intelligent talk or an intellectual talk. So I quit Mr. Dictionary, Mr. Webster right there. Just put it away. And you know, I said my little short serenity prayer, because I was in a hurry to get this done. And my little short serenity prayer is to hell with it. And really, that's a spiritual prayer, because I learned it in church. But I use the long serenity prayer too. And when I'm in a hurry, I like the short one. We've heard of fear a lot, and we've discussed fear at our meetings. And I have taken part in the discussion of fear. Sometimes now I wonder if I knew what I was talking about. And I did a little research, but most of these are my own opinions. And I used to say that my AA has been stole from some other AA. Now I'm getting a little bit more honest. And I say now that my AA was given to me by other AAs, my AA program, that is. And so what I say today is something that has been given to me, my own opinions. And of course, that AA that has been given to me is not original with me. But on this fear, I believe that the AA program is not founded on fear. And therefore, that's just what made me say a little while ago that when I was taking part in these discussions on fear in our AA group meetings and so on and so forth, I realized now probably I didn't know what I was talking about. And I believe now that the AA program is, like I said, is not founded on fear, but founded on the antidote of fear, which is faith. And so, I looked on our program, and I didn't have a program until I got here, and I found no one is really scheduled. us to interfere. And maybe I'd be stepping on someone's toes, and I was glad when I found out nobody really had faith as a topic for discussion. But I still think that fear was a great part of my life, or a big part of my life, rather, in keeping me as a practicing alcoholic. I think probably I was afraid to sober up. I was one of those alcoholics that drank every day. And I had myself fairly well convinced that without alcohol, I'd die. I couldn't live without alcohol. I had my wife fairly well convinced that I had to have a bottle in the house in case I had a heart attack. And I was really afraid to sober up, and I think fear kept me drinking for a long, long time. Fear of going without alcohol kept me drinking. Fear of sobering up, as I said, sobering up and facing the problems that had been caused by my drinking. And fear mostly of this new way of life. That wasn't really for me. And I also was afraid of all of the lies and to sober up, because I didn't want to face all of these lies that I had told people, and face all of the people that I had harmed. So I actually think that if there was any fear in any part of my AA program, that was while I was a practicing alcoholic. I was afraid to go to my first meeting, because I had been contacted by AA 6 months before I went to my first meeting. And believe me, the few sober moments I had in those 6 months before going to my first meeting, I was thinking of AA, but I was afraid of AA. I think maybe fear kept me away from AA those 6 months. And finally, I didn't have any control of my fear anymore, because I was finally hospitalized. And from the hospital, I went to my first meeting. And after the meeting was over, I had to go back to the hospital and spend another 5 days. And so from that, you can gather what kind of a meeting, what kind of condition I was in at my first meeting. And believe me, I was afraid. And I was shaking too, of course. And to get back to fear again, I think mostly, and I'm talking about one alcoholic that I know, that's Chapman. I'm not talking about anyone else but Chapman. I think maybe when I talked about fear at our group discussions and group meetings, I was associating fear with cowardice. And I think maybe that's why I had the wrong misinterpretation of fear, because I used to say all the time that fear didn't keep me sober. And I was thinking of fear along the lines of cowardice. And I wasn't a coward, especially when I was full of whiskey. And I still think probably at our group meetings in Medford, when we get discussing fear, we still associate it with cowardice. As I said before, my interpretations, and they're my interpretations, of the AA philosophy does not concern itself with fear. And as I said before, I think the antidote of fear is faith. And so I probably used faith to overcome fear. And of course, like I said, I was pretty well mixed up when I came to my first meeting. And I'm not too darn sure the first 6 or 8 months, whatever it might be, I'm not too sure whether fear was a major factor or a minor factor in my sobering up, because I was mixed up, as I said. But at least after my thinking cleared up and I was able to grasp just a little bit of what was said at meetings, and I heard someone say, and like most people, you know, I figured I didn't have any faith. Or if I did have faith, I just had a little bit of faith. And I was afraid to use it. And someone told me, he said, use what little faith you have. And he told me, if you don't use it, you'll never get any more. You'll always have but a little bit. And he also told me, the more you use it, the more your faith will grow. That made sense to me after I got rid of some of my stinking thinking. And I started out doing that. And I found that to be very true. And I suppose maybe if this man hadn't told me that, maybe I'd have went along for a long time thinking I don't have any faith. And probably I had fear. And like I said, I'm not sure because I was mixed up. But anyhow, after he told me that, I thought, well, maybe he's right. And so then I started using what little bit of faith I thought I had. And I was surprised he was right. And the more I used that faith, the more my faith seemed to grow. And as of today and as of this very minute, it seems to me I've always had enough of faith since I started using it to meet any problems that has come up. And believe me, I'm going to continue using my faith to overcome any fear I might have. In the big book there on page 101, I'm going to quote just a part of it. It says, in our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield a sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. Goes down to say, if the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a while, but generally winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. And you know, right after I heard this man explain it to me about faith and use what little faith you have to get more, I run across that in a big book one day while I was reading it. And I realized then that I was shielding myself from alcoholism, and maybe it was fear that was shielding me from it, and I put fear in the place of temptation. And when I started using my faith, that came very easy to me. I mean, I didn't have to shield myself anymore from alcoholism or the fear of alcoholism. But the big book says the temptation of alcoholism, and I substituted fear for the word temptation like I explained. And then things seemed to perk up a lot, and they really perked up fast, because I had faith. After I put fear in there, then faith came. And then I had faith in Chapman, faith in a power greater than myself, whom I choose to call God. and faith in the AA program. My faith seems to grow by practicing these principles in all of our affairs, or all of my affairs. In other words, by practicing the AA philosophy, the AA steps, and even some of the AA gimmicks. And it seems to me, the more I practice them, the more faith I have, and the less fear I had. I noticed on the first panel there was some mention made of fear. And I, like I said, I did a little research work on it when I found out I was on this panel. And this is the way I interpret fear, and I just use faith to replace fear, as I've said so many times. And it works for me, and it continues to work for me as long as I practice these principles in all of my affairs. And with that, I want to thank Doug for asking me to be on this panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bert. As I told you before Bert talked, Bert is our delegate to New York for the next 2 years. And I'm sure we're going to be well represented. The next speaker on our panel, I'm going to get into a little corner here eventually with my friend over here, but I must give some credit where credit's due. The next speaker is our former delegate, who just finished his 2-year term, and I think one of the hardest working men in AA in northeastern Wisconsin. He has been for many years. And during his 2 years in office, due to his work, we have a very strong intergroup. We have a very strong association with the groups in New York, with the groups through GSRs and New York. And as we say in the Fox Valley, it's just a hell of an AA. I'd like to introduce Bob Z from Green Bay.
My name is Bob Z, and I am an alcoholic. And my life had become unmanageable. I don't care if you know my last name, but you wouldn't remember it anyhow. It's Signer. Seuchner, if you really want to pronounce it the German way. But my topic is on frustration. And boy, that's a wonderful topic for me, because I was the most frustrated person you ever did see until I came to this AA program. Now, I imagine many of you people have been frustrated at one time or another. Now, this is my own opinions on what frustration is. And if you don't go along with it, it's fine, but it's the way I believe it. I believe frustration is something that is caused by our own doing, or by other people, or by things, circumstances beyond our control. There's many cases of frustration. It could be your wife, could be your boss. It could be things that you do yourself. Now, I was a little frustrated last night, and this is just a case in point. I came down to Racine expecting to drive right up to a motel and get a room. And I drove from here to there and yonder. I know this town pretty good now. And I finally ended up out on the highway on the way to Chicago, and I got a motel room. And I was a little bit frustrated, but whose fault was it? Why didn't I call ahead for reservations? It's kind of like the story of the Irishman that went down to the corner tavern. I don't know why they call them corner taverns. Some of them go in the middle of the block. I used to go all over. But anyhow, he goes down and he gets pretty well organized. And when he comes out, it's raining awful hard and it's muddy and a dirty night. And on his way home, he happened to stumble into an excavation where they were laying a sewer or water line or something. And it was a pretty deep tumble. And he got pretty well banged up. Broke a few bones, a few internal injuries. And he's laying down there in this mud in about 6 inches of water. And somebody happened by and heard his cries for help and said, what can we do for you? Well, he said, the first thing you do, get me a priest. I mean a rabbi. So the guy sends for a rabbi, and then, of course, they send for an ambulance. So pretty soon the rabbi comes, and they get a ladder, and he crawls down in this trench and looks at the guy, and he says, is there anything I can do for you? Yes, he says, I am in pretty bad shape. He says, I wonder if you would give me the last rites. And the rabbi looked at him, and he says, well, I don't think you have the right fellow. He says, I think you should have called for a priest. He says, what? Call for a priest on a, getting him out on a night like this? So I imagine this rabbi was a little frustrated. But we can do something about these frustrations. One of the things I think we have to do is to examine ourselves and know our own abilities. Know what we can do and what we can't do. I think maybe many of us set too high a goal for ourselves, and we cannot reach it, and we are frustrated. See, actually, frustration is when we plan for a certain goal, or we expect a certain thing to happen, and we get almost to that point, and something comes along, and we're defeated in our purpose, and we're frustrated. In other words, it's a defeat of what we expect. And we're going to get that a lot through life. We'll plan a certain thing maybe for weeks. And when the time is almost there, something happens. And it isn't fulfilled, and we're frustrated. So we have to learn to accept these things. One of the things frustration will do, it will cause anxiety. And of course, anxiety is a means of bettering ourselves. If we're anxious about something, we're going to do something about it. It's probably the same as in our drinking. We were awful frustrated. We tried to control this alcohol, and we couldn't. And we were frustrated. And finally, we got anxious about it. We were worried about it. Till finally, we done something about it. So anxiety is actually a means of setting people to do something about this problem. So in this frustration, take it out and examine it. Is it something you caused? Is it something somebody else caused? I know a lot of them get awful frustrated when their anonymity is broken. And of course, like Bert said, it's going to happen. So the thing we have to do, we just have to accept these things and not let them bother us too much. It's going to bother us. But don't keep thinking about it. See, there are many ways of solving this frustration. For an example, there was a Baptist farmer. And of course, Baptists are very devout, very religious. They don't drink, swear, or get mad or anything. They're supposed to be even-tempered. And it so happens this Baptist farmer had a kind of an ornery cow. And one night while he was milking, this cow kicks him and knocks him off the stool into the gutter. He gets up and he walks back and forth. And I imagine he was frustrated, but he says, well, I don't get mad and I don't swear. I don't get mad, and I don't swear. And he picks up his stool, and he sits back down, starts milking, and bang, she clobbers him again. Well, now imagine his frustration was mounting about this time. But he got up, and he slowly walked back and forth, and he says, I don't get mad, and I don't swear. I don't get mad, and I don't swear. And he picks his stool up and sits down again, and just about gets finished, and bang, he gets it again. Well, now imagine this time he was really frustrated, but he knew what to do about it. He picked himself up, he walks around to the front of the cow, and he looks at her. He says, I don't get mad, and I don't swear, but I have a Catholic friend up the road, and I'm going to sell you to him, and he's going to kick the H out of you. So there's some ways of getting over your frustration. You have the answer. But I think the main thing for an alcoholic is to take it easy. Remember your abilities, what you can do. Do not set too high of goals and be disappointed. As we all know, a lot of us would probably aspire to be a great artist. And we can't do it. My ambition was always to be a millionaire, and I know I'll never make it. And sure, it used to frustrate me, it used to bother me, but I learned to accept that fact that I'm not going to be a millionaire. There are some things that you can do about frustration, as in the case of our drinking. I was frustrated about my drinking because I couldn't handle it, and I didn't know why. So, I found out from AA that I was an alcoholic and that I had a disease and that the only thing I could do was join this program and I could be arrested, that I never could go back to being a social drinker and control my drinking again. So I had to accept that fact. And that frustration was gone. I put it away from me because I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic. And there was nothing I could do about it. So why be frustrated about it? Forget it. There isn't a thing you can do. So in your problems that come up, maybe in some cases you can change the people that frustrate you. Maybe in the case of your wife, which I don't know if you can or not. I haven't tried too hard. But maybe there are things that your wife does that bug you and frustrate you. Maybe you can, in a roundabout way, get her to change. But if you can't, accept it. You've lived with it before. But just don't think about it too much. Don't make a big issue of it. It's one of the things we have to live with, the same as we have to live with our alcoholism. If you keep thinking of all the good times you used to have, and why so-and-so can go out and drink and go about his business, and keep that in your mind all the time, it's going to really bug you, and you're going to be frustrated because you can't do it. So why keep thinking about it? Forget it. Accept the fact that you're an alcoholic. It's awful hard to do. That first step, I think, is for an alcoholic, it's one of the hardest things he's done in his life. But until you do, you aren't going to get the peace and contentment and get rid of these frustrations. One thing that this program does, it teaches us how to live. I don't believe I ever knew how to live until I came to this program. I couldn't accept things. Many things are going to happen to us that we don't know the reason why. And we're just going to have to learn to accept them. And this program has taught me that. And I'm very thankful for this. Because when things would happen that I didn't think were right, I was frustrated. I was mad. I was resentful. But I learn now that there are things that's going to happen I have no control over. Accept them. Why get frustrated about it? Because there isn't anything I can do about it. Even if I am anxious about it, I still can't improve it. I can't change it. So I have to accept it. So that's why, if you have a lot of these frustrations, just think of that serenity prayer. Accept the things you cannot change. Change the things that you can or try to change. And have the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you.
think I know something about the frustration that Bob is talking about. I thought that the proper thing for me to do this afternoon would be that after each one of the fellows on the panel talked on his topic, I should get up and say something profound. And they haven't left anything for me to add. And I don't know if I'm frustrated, but I'm a little griped. The next man on our panel is a drinking friend and an AA friend. Paul and I grew up in Oshkosh. That's in Wisconsin, where they make overalls. I joke about that because for the first couple of years that I was in the Navy, everybody I would tell that I was from Oshkosh, they'd laugh. And if they didn't laugh, they'd say, "What is it?" or "Where is it?" or something. So I started saying I was from Milwaukee, a little north of Milwaukee, or a little south of Green Bay. And it worked pretty good. Paul and I drank in the same bar for many years in Oshkosh. And Paul was trying to be helpful to me. He would advise me that I should stop my drinking because I was going to get in trouble. I was in trouble. And, of course, I didn't have enough presence of mind to know that Paul was in trouble also. But one night, a few years ago, somebody in our group, unbeknownst to me, got Paul to talk in one of our meetings. And I walked in. And I don't think either one of us wanted to say why we were there. But it's been a wonderful, renewed relationship. And I would like now to call on Paul S. from Neenah, Wisconsin.
Douglas, drank too much. I doubt it. It's an instantaneous mental attitude. My name is Paul, and there's no doubt right now that I belong here today in my mind. Tomorrow I'll reevaluate the situation. If I were to walk out the door and stand on the street out here and ask the first 100 people that walked by if they thought it was going to rain this afternoon, I think that 85 to 95 would say, "I doubt it." If I were to walk outside and ask the next 100 people if it was going to sun was going to shine all afternoon, "I don't doubt it" would be the answer of 95% of the people. They have to ring in the word doubt. And doubt to me is a mental attitude. It is the inability of myself to come up with something concrete about a certain problem or a certain situation or fact. Vince Lombardi, when he came to the Green Bay Packers, transformed the Packers from a team who doubted whether they could win a game next year to a team that doubted that they were going to lose one. So this thing works both ways. George Halas learned how not to use the word doubt when Willie Wood wrote him a letter and said, "I am 5'9" tall and I weigh 195 pounds and I did this at the Southern California University. Do you think I can be a pro football player?" He wrote back and said, "I doubt it." So Willie wrote Mr. Lombardi, who has eliminated the word doubt from his vocabulary. So what does doubt mean as far as the AA program is concerned? When I came to the AA program and took a look at the 12 steps, it reminds me of the page 53 in the big book. What a task. I can't go through with it. I doubted if any one of these 12 steps applied to me or my life applied to any part of them, because I didn't want to apply them to anything that I was doing. And this is where I get to the mental attitude of the word doubt. If I don't think that I can hit a home run, I'm going to doubt this. I'm not going to do it because I doubt it. It seems to be a word that a person would rather say doubt than say yes or no. And if I were to sit down and say I'm an alcoholic the first day I came to an AA meeting, I looked at that and said, "Well, it could be, but I doubt it. I doubt that it applies to me." And yet, if I were to say I am absolutely an alcoholic, there is no doubt about it, and go through all 12 of those steps and say these 12 steps minimize the doubt that you have. Because I think that if you eliminate doubt completely, 100%, you're going to have this program, as we call it, made. And you can't do that. You have to keep exploring it on a daily basis. You have to keep doing step number 11. You have to go back over and do step number 1. You can't say that there's no doubt in my mind that I have this program knocked. Because if you do this, then you have eliminated the doubt of the thing, the mystery that the AA program has given me. I can't conceive of myself the first 6 months that I was on this program saying that I'm never going to take a drink again or on and on, this and this applies to this. I was going to step number 4 and I was making out a list and I got to a certain few things and I said, I doubt if I'll put those down because I don't want to get to those. I doubted this program. The program says we do the best that we can. So I can't doubt it, and yet I can't overdo this thing the other way. As we grow in the program, doubt decreases. I think it's an increase in confidence and a decrease in doubt. And by that I mean, let's take a child for an as compared to us as adults. I think that a child has no limitations. He doesn't know his limitations. That's why they can do a lot of things way beyond their capabilities. I have a 9-year-old son who is a fair student in English and social studies and everything, but he's an almost a sophomore in high school in mathematics because he doesn't know he has to stop at the 4th grade. And he gets books out and... But if I were to go to school now and be in college again and at the senior level, and someone would say, here's your math course, and you can go on and become a doctorate without even knowing it, you'd say, well, I doubt that I have the capabilities of doing that. So we as adults must work within our limitations. We have to know exactly what level we want to put this program on or any other thing that we try to accomplish. Because if we can set ourselves a goal by which to work, we can eliminate or minimize the doubt that it's going to succeed by not getting all hepped up and worried over something that we know or actually feel we can never do. That's why it's very important to keep this program simple. It minimizes the doubt that it can work for you. And doubt is a horrible thing, actually, because it breeds failure. If you doubt that you can do something, chances are that you're not going to do it, or do it successfully, or to do it to any degree at all. So we have to minimize doubt as much as possible within our limitations. And you can do this by limiting yourself. I could take this program that we're working, and I'm working today, to the best of my ability, and say, now I'm going to expand in my knowledge of this program, and I'm going to go out and grab a flag, and I'm going to become the Messiah for this group. And I'd probably end up down in the middle of the street saloon. But I think I have my capabilities generalized on this program to the point where I know what I have to do to stay sober today. And it's following the 12 steps, working them, making them become a way of life for me. There's no doubt in my mind that if I follow those 12 steps today, that I'm not going to drink until midnight. If I can do this as simply and as honestly and as doubt-free as possible. And we'll let tomorrow take care of itself, because tomorrow, I've never been in tomorrow. I've never made it yet. But if I can minimize the doubts that I have, and I have them every day. There are days, I was in Eau Claire Wednesday and Thursday and Friday for a convention. There's a bar full of people. There were 2 different conventions going on there, and if I looked at these people having a ball, and I said, geez, here I am, 5 years ago. Why couldn't I do this for one day? I was snowbound in Iowa a year ago, right last month, in a situation an alcoholic dreams of. Joe knows. I was working for the same company he was. Unlimited expense account, and you can't get out of there for 5 days. And I'm sitting right on top of a saloon. But you have to know your limitations. You doubt whether if you do this thing, if the word doubt comes in there, I doubt if my wife will find out about it. I doubt if somebody, you can't let this happen. You have to know your limitations and know what you want to get out of this program. And if you eliminate or minimize, if you minimize the doubt that you have about any one of the 12 steps or anything that you have to do to stay sober, the chances of your staying sober are much better. A strong doubt gives me an avenue to escape. I can pick out any one of the 12 steps or any part of one of the 12 steps and doubt it very seriously in my own mind and build up this doubt on a daily basis until maybe a year from now or 2 years from now, who knows? I can grab hold of that doubt and run. But if I had minimized it and kept it down and built it up through faith, built up the strength against that doubt, my chances of overcoming that obstacle at a time are greater. But a person can use the grabbing hold of a doubt or the building up of a doubt as an avenue sometime in the future. So we have to watch this. We have to minimize the word doubt or the implication of doubt into the AA program. We have to analyze the 12 steps as to what I have to do and how I can apply these 12 steps to my life as easily and simply as possible so as to minimize the results. Every AA man that I've seen, a woman that's happy, keeps this program simple. We have a fellow that came to our group, and Nina, he was there when I got there almost 4 years ago, 3.5, 4 years ago. And he got involved in step number 3, and all of a sudden he started to think that he was carrying the cross down College Avenue in Appleton. This guy started reading books way beyond his comprehension, and he ends up flat on his can. And he's been sitting there wondering why guys like Doug and I, who are mentally inferior to him, he says, can make this program when a great brain like him can't get it, because he had put this word doubt. He doubts that step number 3 applies to him. He doubts the fact that he has not got the capability to conquer step 3 as far as he wants to. He hasn't put the cap on step 3. Here's as far as I go with this thing, and this is going to keep me sober. He goes way beyond this thing, starts carrying the flag and the cross, and he starts drinking. Because he created himself a situation where he doubted the ability of step 3 to help him stay sober. So I say again, if we can minimize doubt, take a lot of things for granted. I had to do that when I came to this program. I think that one of the best ways of getting rid of doubt is to just take things for granted. Pat T. from Appleton told me this when I was on the program for 2 weeks. He said it has worked for approximately 500,000 people because they have the faith that these 12 steps can keep them sober. Whether they can argue any one of the 12 steps is fine, but they have the faith that they are going to keep them sober. Keep him sober. And I had to apply this to myself. I had to eliminate doubt and accept the fact that there was a power greater than myself. I never was a churchgoer, and I'm not a great churchgoer today. But I have faith in a power greater than myself because it tells me in the book that I must. And I have faith in step number 4, in the fact that if I do a step number 4 to the best of my ability, it's going to keep me sober. And on down the line through the 12 steps. I accept them. They work for you people, and if they can work for me, they'll work for me. It's as simple as that. So that thereby I've eliminated the doubt by accepting the fact that these 12 steps have worked for so many people and they work for me. But I've eliminated the doubt. Thank you.
I think if I ever get the opportunity to get a panel together again, we'll have some kind of an agreement that we sign that we won't question the moderator's mental capabilities. I was thinking while he was standing up here talking about that, I think I finally figured out why he was never an All-American when he played football in Minnesota. It's with the hands like this he was dropping the ball.
Well, Joe, there's not room enough to finish the fourth panelist completely on this track, so rather than start him and break in and have you turn the tape, we'll leave the rest of this track blank, and we're on side one, track one on this tape, so without changing track selector, we'll just flop the tape and that'll put us on side two, track four. And we'll be introduced to Al G. from Iron Mountain, Michigan, who will talk on the subject of loneliness, and the panel closes right after that. That should leave us room enough on track four to go to the A Center for Sunday morning speaker, and then I'll go to one of the inside tracks. I'll have to go to both inside tracks to give you the Saturday night program at the banquet. So to continue listening to the panels without my yakking here, losing your train of thought or getting you away from the conference, let's go over there to side two, track four.
Hi, Bill. This is Joe Mosio again. And as Jerry mentioned there, that he put that last speaker of the Four Horsemen on the other side of the tape, so that would leave it a blank spot here on this side. And it will run to about 772. On my recorder, it's from 690 to 772. I don't know whether I'll be able to talk to you all that time or not. But I'm checking this side two of this tape here, and so far it sounds pretty good. Yev is coming out very clear on track two below this, and I don't know exactly where I got this Lynn Carroll. I don't know whether he's after this here or whether he's on track two. But I remember when I was making up this copy for you that when I got the copy off of him, it was on both of the tracks, or was, I forgot exactly how it was. He put it on one track and it didn't finish, so he put it on another track, so I would get the whole talk on one track instead of as he did it, but he forgot to erase that. So what I'll have to do is find out exactly how this works and erase that track and leave that good one there for you. Having nice weather here in Chicago, about 70 degrees. Didn't have too much rain. If you're intending to go to that Madison conference, I doubt if you will, because you've mentioned so much about you going running around the month of September and maybe October. You won't be able to get up there. But I'll drop you a line, but I think you might be getting all them tapes from Dan Olson, so I won't give you any of them. I could give you the Rockford Conference, and or I've got other tapes now that it's getting a little cooler. Won't be running around too much, more or less staying around the house a little more and be able to catch up on some of these talks that old people are and exchanging. And incidentally, would like to put on this here little shorty tape I got from Paul Arondash, and who works for Dick Garin at Chitchat Farms in Pennsylvania. Got this, I don't know when, about 6 months ago or so, off of him. He's got some music in the background, and he more or less talks to it. I think you'll like it. I don't know whether you exchange with him or not, but he's another guy that exchanges tapes with Anton Stork, and I owe him a tape for a long time there. last tape I sent him is one tape that his boss had made up. By his boss, I mean Dick Caron, who talked in Iowa. I was at that conference there. And incidentally, I just thought of it now. You mentioned something about doing some sort of prison work. I've got quite a few tapes from a friend of mine by the name of Tiny Enfield. His real name is Cleo, but they call him Tiny. He's a outside sponsor in the Fort Madison, Iowa penitentiary there. I've been up there a couple times. And he sent me quite a few good tapes that if you're interested in something like that, I could send you some of those. And one thing about these tapes over there, that they don't use that everyday language that the people on the outside use. So if I do give you some of them, that have to be more or less careful when you play them, because the jokes and the language isn't for everybody to hear. But you can let me know about that. I see we're getting close to this here, 766. It starts at 770, so I better shut this off, and I'll talk to you a little more later on or on the other track. Bye for now.
This is side number two, track number four. We are at Racine, Wisconsin at the 15th Annual Spring Conference of the Southern Wisconsin Area of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're sitting in a panel discussion entitled The Four Horsemen. We have listened on side one, track one, to the subject of fear, frustration, and doubt. On the subject of loneliness, we will now be introduced to Al G. of Iron Mountain, Michigan.
Our next speaker is very familiar to all you folks in the southern area. He was your main speaker 2 years ago, I believe, on Lover's Lane Road or somewhere outside of town. Also his wife, of course, Ruth. And we were talking before. Somebody called me yesterday about asking me what time if I was going to be busy after the conference or something, and they said, what time do the four horsemen ride? We were discussing, there are some people who believe that where Al's from, in upper northern Michigan, they still use horses. In fact, Billy said, Bob's wife, just before the meeting, don't they? So with that, I'll turn you over to Al G. from Iron Mountain, Michigan.
Thank you, Doug. I wasn't sure as to what Doug might say in the way of an introduction. Knowing his background, being familiar with the fact that he was a good Irishman, I wasn't sure when the blarney was going to stop and the honesty would begin. I'm happy to be with you. I'm grateful for the opportunity to come down to southern Wisconsin again to attend one of your fine conferences. We had a wonderful ride down yesterday, a beautiful drive, and you know, the trip passed so fast. When we crossed Left Foot Creek, I suddenly became aware of the fact that we were crossing that parallel which divides the globe, a midpoint between the North Pole and the equator. And I myself. Golly, I didn't know we'd gone that far. Following these wonderful guys on this panel today creates quite a problem for me. I was thinking a moment ago about this guy Daniel, you know, when he approached the lion's den. Following these fellows, I thought about Daniel because I thought perhaps he probably said, "I'd rather be the after-dinner speaker."